You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
I'm Denora Gattaccio, campaign manager and legislative counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. For today's podcast, we're here with New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito to talk about some of the reforms the council is considering to expand access to the ballot and reform our criminal justice system. Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito, thank you for being with us today. During your 2016 State of the City speech, you spoke at length very early in your speech about the importance of increasing civic engagement and easing the voting process, which is definitely music to our ears at the Brennan Center, given our deep commitment to modernizing voter registration and making elections more free, fair, and accessible for all Americans. Can you explain in more detail the voting reforms contained in your plan that you can implement locally and when we can expect to see those changes take effect?
Sure. So obviously, you know, we want to figure out ways that we can engage young and old more in the voting process. There are clearly things that are beyond our direct purview, right? Things that the state has to change laws, and if we wanted to do day of voter registration, which I would love to see happen in New York State, happens in many other cities and states. Those are things that the state has to do. So we were taking a look at exactly what can we do within the city, things that we have responsibility for and oversight over that we could implement. So we're looking at the use of technology as a way of engaging people in that voting process. One would be through an online voter notification portal, you know, an application. Many people use their smartphones these days, where they could find out how to get access to an absentee ballot that would be able to find out what is your voter history, for instance. Where are your voting sites, et cetera. Information that's easily accessible. Using text messaging, for instance, as a way of doing like push notifications. Like, okay, this is the voting day. Be sure you vote. Reminding people to vote. Finding out ways where they can do that. So using technology as a way of engaging people more. And I think that that's something that we have the ability to do within New York City. And obviously, poll sites change. Right. That's also a way to disenfranchise voters. People don't know that the site has changed, and so being able to also provide notification when that happens and where the latest polling sites are. So that's one aspect of it. How do we work with the Board of Elections to implement those things? And then there's things that we're doing, for instance, today,
right?
Student Voter Registration Day that is happening throughout the city of New York. Last year, it was a process which was maybe in 20 schools, 2,000 students in high schools across New York City public schools registered. This year, we've amplified that many times over. We're probably in over 100 schools. The hope is that we'll register 10,000 students. I just came from Manhattan Center, where there were about 300 kids in the room, talked about the importance of civic engagement, the importance of voting, that their voice needs to be heard, and so those kids registered today. So that's happening across the city, and we want to see that grow. So we're going to have 10,000 potential new voters in the city out of that process. So really excited. Those are kind of some of the things that we're doing as a way of engaging potential voters, and also how do we continue to engage existing voters.
That's great. And just speaking specifically to Student Voter Registration Day, because that was a great initiative that was launched during your tenure as speaker, talk to us about the energy of the students there today, and like, do they understand the responsibility they have? And, you know, presidential elections seem to have more turnout. Did they feel like, did you get the sense that they would be prepared to sign up and also turn out and actually do their civic responsibility?
So I think that it's multifold, right? So there definitely were about 350 kids that registered. I allowed them the opportunity to ask me questions. I asked them questions. I said, do you know right now in the neighborhood that you live, who is your council member? Unfortunately, many don't know. So a way of letting them know that in order to hold us accountable, if there are things happening in your neighborhood that you're not happy about, one is that you can directly communicate with your elected official, and that's why it's important to know who that person is. And two, that you can register to vote and vote as a way of exercising your discontent or your contentness with that elected official. So we engaged in that conversation, but definitely was an interest. They were asking questions about basic stuff that we would consider, like when you register, they're telling me Democrat, you know, Republican, Green Party, Independent, like what does that mean? And I told them, I said, we have a primary process in the city that depending on what party you enroll in, you can vote for a candidate in each of those basic questions. I encouraged them to look at our website so that they could know who their council member is. I explained what the city council does, that it is the local legislative body for the city of New York. So there was a lot of engagement in kids understanding some of these kids may be the first in their family to be voting, right? And the importance of bringing that message to their parents,
right,
to their household, to their neighbors, to their other friends. So I think this is really powerful to see that, that, you know, in all aspects, in all corners of our city, starting to get these kids to really question the process and understand the role that they have within it. Partnering that, I think one of the things, the reason I believe very strongly about participatory budgeting,
right,
which we've been doing now for 5 years, I think it ties in very well to that way of talking about continuation and that continuum of civic engagement. Participatory budgeting allows young people in our neighborhoods, as young as 14, which is way below the voting age in this city, in this country, to basically vote on projects that they deem important in their communities. We start teaching them at an early age the importance of getting engaged. And we've seen a great number of young people across the 5 years participate in the process. And I think that that leads really nicely into them understanding them when they have the ability to register to vote, why voting is important, and taking that opportunity to register. So that's why I believe so much in the power of participatory engagement, and the participatory budgeting process that we've done is one way of doing that. And I'd like to see that in other settings in government, figuring out ways that we can create opportunities for people to express themselves and to take ownership for government and for the process.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And another thing that I think that goes dovetails nicely with this notion of Student Voter Registration Day and ensuring that there is a base level understanding of how government functions, mm-hmm, and the role of government is civics education. And I know that's something that you were talking about in your speech as well. How well is the City Department of Education doing in that regard now? What would you recommend to improve that?
Well, I mean, that's something that I think we have to improve upon. I don't think we've done a real exhaustive or some oversight hearing about what the Department of Education is doing. How does it involve civic education in its curriculum? But I think there's work to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to sit in a room of high school students and they're not really understanding what the city council does concerns me, right? I tried to equate it. I said, listen, you've probably studied about the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Right.
Well, we are the local legislative body for the city of New York, so like trying to break it down. So there's work that we need to do, and I would love to work with the Department of Education to figure out how we really make it, you know, break it down so that people understand it in their day-to-day life. That's what we have to do. It's like, in order for people to really understand what their responsibilities are, is to make it relevant to their immediate life and to their immediate circumstances, and not talk about it, you know, really in an abstract setting. So that's what I'd like to figure out. I'm not sure exactly how much of that is happening at the public school curriculum.
Well, hopefully that's an opportunity for you and the council to continue to push the Department of Education to be more accountable in that regard.
Yes.
Which is great for our democracy as a whole. Turning to some of the specific technological improvements that you're recommending around civic engagement and voter access, do you expect that the online voter portal and some of the notifications via text message are going to be available in time for this 2016 election cycle?
I doubt that.
Okay.
Working with our Board of Elections, I think there's some challenges.
Wishful thinking.
Right. I mean, obviously, I would love things to happen that immediately. But definitely, we would like to happen as quickly as possible. Hopefully, we could figure something out where maybe by next year we start seeing some aspects of this proposal rolling out. So we have a lot of work to do.
Definitely, and it seems like that's something that will be a great topic of discussion during the upcoming mm-hmm. budget negotiating mm-hmm. process to think about. Are there even, you know, minimal steps that can be taken to be funding those efforts this year? A lot of your speech you also spent talking about, as you called it, quote-unquote, doubling down on criminal justice reform,
yes,
and enhancing public safety.
Yep.
In particular, you launched the citywide bail fund. Can you explain to us what that is and how that improved criminal justice outcomes for New York City?
So we're trying to tackle, and this is something that I feel very strongly about, so we're trying to tackle the issue of criminal justice reform in many different ways. At the end of the day, it's about how do we lessen people's interaction with the criminal justice system, which many times that interaction can lead to a permanent criminal record and really stunt their ability to really fully fulfill their potential, right? May not get a job, or it may limit their ability to get housing, or et cetera. Many different ways that it can impact somebody's life. And sometimes this interaction with the criminal justice system are for very low-level, like nonviolent offenses, that if you hear some of the reasons why people are getting arrested these days, it sounds ridiculous. One of the things that we also know is, so we're trying to also talk within that setting, how to limit the pretrial detention rates in particularly Rikers, where people are being held while they await their trial. There are many people that are being held at Rikers 8 to 10 to 14 days simply because they can't pay a low-cost bail, right? So if you and I get charged for the same nonviolent low-level offense, if you can pay the $200 bail, you can leave and wait your trial date at home. If I can't pay because I'm poor, then I sit in Rikers for 10 to 12 days. And that obviously has a lot of implications. You could lose your job. You could lose custody of your children, et cetera. So we talked about creating, and these bail funds now exist in a very limited pilot program.
Right.
So talking about creating it citywide, where we did already allocate in the budget money for it. And we've already found a community-based partner that would implement it, and we've dedicated some administrative costs to it. We're just waiting for some state regulations to certifications to come through so that we can fully implement it. But it is that we're going to define certain regulations, who would be eligible.
Okay.
That's being defined with the administration about who would be eligible for it. But usually it would be for very low, for low-income individuals, for low-level nonviolent offenses. And they would have access to the bail fund so that they could leave Rikers and then be able to then await their trial date. So very excited about that. I think that would have an impact on thousands of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping within the next month or 2 months that we'll be getting the appropriate designation so that we can start rolling it out.
And you mentioned a partner that
yes.
would work with you. Does that the partner responsible for ensuring that the person stays in their home as they've been released to custody of, or released to their neighborhood, if you will? Like, what's their role?
They would be administering it,
okay.
right? Who anybody that asks to applies for it or asks for access to the bail fund, they would have to make sure that they meet the criteria.
Got it.
So basically we have the models that exist right now locally. So we have examples of how to, run it and administer it. So that's what the local partner would do and help raise money for it. We're providing the administrative costs. The community partner is working to really raise the money privately so that the bail fund is insured. And, believe it's going to be, and we may decide to expand it later on, but right now we're looking at probably $1.4 million a year, $1 million for the bail fund itself, $400,000. To kind of administer it. And again, it would be self-funding, right? Because people get to their trial date, the money gets returned, so it kind of rolls, keeps rolling forward. So I'm very excited about that and can't wait for it to be rolled out fully.
Well, yeah, we look forward to monitoring that as well and seeing how it's implemented going forward.
Yes.
Another major initiative you announced during your speech was a package of bills to reform and increase transparency at the Department of Corrections. Which of those reforms that you announced you believe will go the farthest in reforming Rikers, if you will?
Well, we basically have already done a whole bunch of of transparency bills to more reporting bills
mm-hmm.
to get more information in terms of the inmate population incidents, violence incidents. So we've just been setting forth those, and those should be in place soon. So we've done that right now. Though what we've been recommending now moving forward, and also for the first time ever, we as a city council nominated someone who's a formerly incarcerated individual to sit on the Board of Corrections. That had not been done on the council side. I think the admin had done it previously, but we were very proud to be able to put somebody on there who has that inside experience that can really speak to that and be part of the Board of Corrections, which is the entity that does the regulations for the Department of Corrections. So what we've recommended right now is, one is the creating the independent Criminal Justice Commission that's going to be chaired by Judge Lippman
mm-hmm.
to take a look at Rikers and possibly make recommendations as to its possible closure. He just announced the commission members yesterday, 24 members, 27 members, very varied experiences. So very excited about that and the work that they'll engage in. We continue to fight to raise the age of criminal responsibility. We're only one of two states that continues to not be able to do that. We talked about, and we're going to set forth legislation to create a municipal division of transition services that people that are coming out of Rikers or people that are be able to integrate fully and get access to services and make sure that they are able to integrate successfully into our society. That's important. We talked about codifying an inspector general for the Department of Corrections.
Mm-hmm.
There is an inspector general, but it's not codified, and it really doesn't specify what their responsibilities are, so we're looking to do that. We're looking at expanding violence-based adult programming at Rikers, creating more opportunities for people to engage. A lot of times, what we understand from the statistics is that the reason there's increases in violence is because there's too much idle time. A lot of the programming that was available to inmates before has been removed. You know, people don't have access to continuing education programs, CTE programs, whatever it may be. There's a need to bring that back. And also because we want people to have the skills to be able to come back into our communities and be able to be employed. And then also looking at a video visitation program at Rikers. The idea that people are at Rikers, it takes family members a full day. They'd have to take time off work to visit their loved ones. We think that being isolated, obviously, is not helpful right. if we want people to reintegrate successfully. So the idea of maintaining some level of contact with their loved ones, we're talking about working with our public library system and other places where we create opportunities for family members to have access to video visitation and engage in that. We're excited about the potential. So we're working actively on with the Department of Corrections and the administration to figure out ways that we can make the experience of people at Rikers less punitive and really see them as who they are, members of our community, that we want them to be able to kind of come back and be able to be employed and be successful without being, being treated in such a punitive way, which could turn them in a different direction and be much more of a burden to us as a society. So there's a lot of work to do there, but we're really focused on it. It was a real focus of my State of the City, and it will be a continued focus in the next, almost 2 years that I have left as Speaker.
And that's good. If I could follow up just even on the specific, the bill you mentioned that would increase transparency about the operations at Rikers, will that feed into the commission and the work that they're doing? And is there a timetable for the commission to put forth recommendations about Rikers and improving that?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that all these reporting bills and transparency bills and the data that we will get out of those is definitely something that the commission would want to make, want to be able to look at and review as it deliberates. I think the idea here would be to maybe within a year, take the time. Thankfully, Judge Lippman's law firm is providing a lot of pro bono assistance here, and that's going to help and facilitate this. And so we're hoping that within a year they can come out with a set of solid recommendations and be very excited that we can then figure out, once that blueprint is provided, how then we start implementing it.
That's right. The last question I have on this specific point is just around the relationship between the council and the criminal justice coordinator. It seemed like that it would be crucial to seeing how these proposals unfold and ensuring that they can see the light of day, if you will. How's it going so far with working with City Hall and the recommendations you've issued so far?
No, I think it's good. There was some resistance at the beginning with the idea of this commission, but we're going to, Judge Lippman has indicated that he definitely wants the administration and the mayor's office to be involved, obviously. We're going to have to go to them, and the commission's going to have to ask for information or see how receptive they are to maybe some of the ideas that they're looking at. So they're part of the process. They're not on the commission per se. Right. Neither are we. Right. And that's why we want them to be as independent as possible. But they'll be part of the conversation, that's going to happen. So there's openness to it. We've been working very closely with the Criminal Justice Coordinator's Office with the Criminal Justice Reform Act that we are putting forth. How do we deal with nonviolent low-level offenses? Mm-hmm. How does the NYPD deal with them? There was a lot of resistance to our recommendations at the beginning, but I think that due to us putting it out there and taking the hits that we've taken, and now people are really seeing the importance of what we're proposing, that we shouldn't be putting somebody in jail because they were in a park after dark, if they're drinking an open container, why not give them a summons and a fine and not necessarily incarcerate them? The idea of not being so punitive but still finding a way to hold people accountable, and I think that's important. So we've been working very closely with the Criminal Justice Coordinator's Office on that and many other issues. Right now, we're also working with them on this issue of these 1.5 million outstanding warrants that exist, and the idea that if there's an open warrant 10 years old, 10 years from 10 years ago and older, mm-hmm. the idea of maybe just forgiving it, because that means that person has not had any sort of interaction with the criminal justice system for 10 years. And if it's a low-level nonviolent offense, then, again, it's really ineffective and inefficient for us to be holding that, what it means for the NYPD in terms of resources, what it deals for our courts in terms of those open warrants. So there's a lot of inefficiencies in the system that we need to clear up. and so that we can be more focused and effective in fighting the harder crime. So those are some of the things. But they've been open, and we've been working very closely with them. So there's a lot more work to do.
As always, right? That's if government was not continuing to work together and think about how to solve problems, we wouldn't have a functioning government. My last question for you is one that's kind of broad and reflective, if you will. You will be ending your third term as... not to be doomsday. As a city council member serving the East Harlem and South Bronx communities at the end of 2017, you were the first Puerto Rican woman and Latina to serve in this office and also to serve as speaker. When you look back on your service, what would you want to have your legacy reflect?
You know, my legacy is what I tell people is that what I hold in my heart is about equity and justice for everybody, right? And as a woman, as a Latina, you know, I want people to treat me fairly and, you know, and that I be treated equitably. So if I want that for myself, I need to fight for that for everybody else. And so creating a fair system has really been the reason why, you know, I ran for office. One was to give a voice to my community, which historically had been very much disenfranchised, and making sure that our voice was heard. And now as speaker, having the ability to influence public policy at a citywide level to create more equity and justice. That's why I fight for the immigration matters. And we've created some great policies and initiatives at the city council level that helps immigrant New Yorkers, and now looking at the criminal justice system to create more equity and justice there. So that's what I want my legacy to be. That's what I want people to know about me, and that I be remembered for having fought for those things and made progress in those areas. I'm not going to solve all the problems, but if we move the barometer a little bit, then, you know, we're heading in a good direction. And that's what I would like to leave. And I'm excited about all the work we've engaged in, the debates that we've stirred, and the progress that we will achieve as a result of that. We haven't been afraid to take on certain challenges, and these have been challenging issues. These have been issues that some people have been afraid to tackle in the past, but it's important, because we know that African-American, Latino communities in particular, when it comes to criminal justice system, have received a really unfair shake. And that the system has been set up in a way which really treats those communities differently than others. And that's the reality. We do have racism that permeates some of our systems, and that is something that we can't shy away from, and we got to figure out how do we straighten that out. You know, how do we uproot that racism and create a system that treats everybody the same? Not going to be solved in my lifetime, probably, but it's something that motivates me to continue to take charge in those areas and to bring that out into the open. So that's what we've been doing, and I'm excited about what we've been able to achieve in a short period of time.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today. And we look forward to seeing the next 2 years unfold, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.